Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. And I am your host, John Hansen. And happy Father's Day, everybody. All you fathers out there, I hope you had a great day today. I called my dad early this morning and wished him a happy Father's Day. And I believe my brother, who is also a father, is on his way with his family to California. And my nephew, who just graduated from Purdue University in Indiana, is about to start a job for Gallo Wine out in Modesto, California. So congratulations to my nephew. He's doing great. And then my brother-in-law, Eric, he's having a good day also. So happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. Hope you guys had a great day today. On the show today, we have Mr. John Lloyd, and if you follow bodybuilding at all recently, you probably know his son, Boston Lloyd, B-O-S-T-I-N, and Boston, he's made quite a name for himself because he is always very honest in his interviews about steroid use, and so a lot of people know who Boston Lloyd is. He always gets a lot of hits, and he's very famous. I believe he's like a contest prep coach. But I remember his dad from the 1970s, and he competed in California, and he competed with Mike Christian and Rory Liedemeyer during those early 1980 shows, like at the Mr. California. He was also second place to Gary Stridham at the 1984 MPC USA, the one that Phil Williams won the overall, but Gary Stridham won the heavyweight class. So John has been around for a long time, and I believe he owned one of the first Gold's Gym franchises that Ed Connors decided to franchise when they started to franchise them with Ed Connor, Pete Gromkowski, and Tim Kimber. John owned one of the first ones in San Francisco, so he's going to talk about that. But he's got a lot of great old bodybuilding stories about some of the guys that went through his gym, some of the great bodybuilders, and also about his time competing when he was at the top of the amateur world. He was really training hard and competing. He had a really good physique, real tall guy, very big, real good legs. So we're going to hear from John Lloyd in a second. And before we go any further, I want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've known Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. And it's the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning Fat Burner, which is Vintage Burn, the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. And speaking of Old School Labs, they just made my flight arrangements for the Mr. Olympia. So I am officially going to the Mr. Olympia in middle of September. So it should be like, what, July, August, 3 more months. 3 months away. It'll be here before you know it. So I'm excited about that. I was there last year. That was the first time I'd went in many, many years, so I'm excited to go again. I don't think they'll have a booth this year, so if you're at the expo and looking for the Old School Labs booth, they will not have one, but we will be around the expo. I'll be at the expo both days, Friday and Saturday, and I'll be with Tom Platz and Samir, and we're going to be doing our wrap-ups of the contest. We'll probably go to the pre-judging on Friday and then, of course, the finals on Saturday, and we'll do it just like we did last year. So that was a lot of fun last year, and I'm looking forward to going again. And my training has been going really good. I am in the Mass Cycle training program now, so I keep you guys up to date on that every week. And I just finished up Mass Week number 2. I'm getting into number 3. Things are going really good with my training. I'm really feeling good. I'm feeling big, and I'm trying to get the diet going so I can get a little bit leaner. And hopefully I'll be really lean by the time we go to the Olympia. That'll give me something to shoot for. And I finished up that Mr. America book finally, the one written by John D. Fair. It was a really extensive book, talked about the whole history of the Mr. America contest. Basically, what the book does is it starts really from the beginning of bodybuilding, when it started in the 1800s with Eugene Sandow, and how bodybuilding competitions were sort of modeled off of the ancient Greek sculptures. So they were basically looking for a very symmetrical proportion physique and not really so much with muscle mass. And then when the Mr. America contest started, which was 1939, they sort of copied off of the Miss America contest. So they were looking for the ideal American man. And if they figure this is during World War II or right around that time, so they were looking for a man who was the epitome of what an American man should be. So he should be muscular, good-looking, well-spoken, athletic, and that's how they got to use the athletic points by having to do the weightlifting competitions. They also had interviews with all the competitors to see what kind of personality they had. So they were kind of basing it off of the Miss America contest. And then they had some controversial decisions because the most muscular guys were not winning. They were losing to guys who did better in the interviews or had better athletic points from lifting the weights. So they started to change that a little bit, and there was a lot of controversy on which way they should go with it. And then eventually the physique started to get more muscular. And then by the time you get to the 1960s, of course, steroids came into it, and then the guys started getting much bigger. And then there was always this judging quandary. Do they go with the more symmetrical physique, or do they go with the more muscular physique? And at the time, Weider and the IFBB was very small. They started officially in the 1940s, but they had very few competitions. And they were trying to get involved with the AAU, and Bob Hoffman did not like them. So they had a big battle, and then they were going back and forth in the magazines. Bob Hoffman would say stuff about Weider and strength and health and in muscular development. And then Weider would say stuff about Bob Hoffman and muscle builder and power. And then they had the writers working for him, and it was really a big mess. So, and this literally went on for decades where they were fighting with each other. And then finally, Weider started his own Mr. America contest. And then Dan Laurie started the Mr. America contest. And then there was multiple Mr. Universes, multiple Mr. Americas. And then finally, when Ken Sprague came in, he got things really organized. And then they started the MPC. They tried to take the Mr. America title away from the AAU, but they wouldn't allow it. They went to court. The court sided with the AAU because, of course, they had been running it since the 1930s. And then Weider started his own Mr. America contest. And then eventually they just said, screw it, let's just start our own organization, which was the MPC. And then once that started, the Mr. America quickly went down. And according to this book, Mr. America, the last Mr. America contest was 1999. And now they're trying to restore it. We just had John Colacione on a few weeks ago, and he is working with Rafael Santoya, and they are starting their own IFBB organization, and they're going to try and do some drug testing and bring the Mr. America back. So pretty interesting book. If you want to learn about the history of the sport, I would definitely recommend it. It was kind of a downer, though, when you think about the whole history of the sport and how the drugs really came in. And according to the author, he feels that they really ruined the physiques. And, you know, where we are now, where the guys are very, very big. Interesting read. So check it out if you get a chance. It's called Mr. America. I really liked it because it really gave me a sense of history, a lot more than I knew, and I consider myself an historian of the sport. All right, our interview last week with Skip Robinson got some really good feedback, especially on Facebook. Jose Raymond, who is also from the East Coast, Jose is from Massachusetts, and he said, I'm looking forward to this interview. Skip is one of the nicest people I've ever met and has a genuine passion for bodybuilding. Jerry Scalise, another former interview on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, said, these podcasts are great. It brings back a lot of memories growing up as a kid and following all the past great pioneers of bodybuilding. I remember rushing to the local stationery store to see what new training routines were in the muscle magazines back then. Richard Perillo said, Jerry, I just listened to your podcast interview with John again last night. Great stuff, champ. We did have one negative review of the podcast. Sergio Moshia said, please wake me up when it's over. And I asked him if he didn't like it, and he said, it's not your fault. But he said, every time you ask Skip a question, he rambled on and he never answered anything. Let's face it, we all want to hear what it was like to see and work out with Arnold in person. Instead, he kept telling you how Arnold told him how beautiful he looked. Richard Perillo said, I, for one, am really looking forward to this interview with the amazing Skip Robinson. Kirkman Worley said, the last three or four guests you have had are some of the best examples of a truly aesthetic physique. Joe Means, another former interview on our show, said he was looking forward to this one. Artie Lamparella said he always liked Skip's physique. I never met him, but he sounds like such a modest gentleman. Besides having such a great body, he was super strong. I listened to it twice. That main accent, still just the stories of Arthur Jones, was worth the listen. Another stellar job. Bravo. And Skip answered, thank you for the kind words. What accent? And then Artie said, Skip, I know with my Bronx accent, I shouldn't talk. That was a remarkable account. All my favorites are your friends. You were just amazing. You left a rich legacy. Thanks to my dear friend, Dennis Tinerino, we had so many adventures. Also, my good friend, John DeCola, and the iconic Marvin Etter. I hope one day to meet you. Until then, stay well. Patrick Neves said, a great guy. Tom Terwilliger said his physique resembles Ron Tufel quite a bit. Andrew Herman said, great podcast. Scott McNally from Bodybuilding Nerds Radio said, this was a great interview, John. Thanks for sharing it with us. My brother-in-law, Eric Gallagher, said, I could listen to Skip Robinson's stories all day. Great show, John. And then Scott McNally also said, I saw you mention on a post that Chris Aceto was one of your students. He's talking to Skip. He said, do you mean you actually taught him in school, or was he into bodybuilding yet? And I listened to the interview too, Scott, and I couldn't really tell what Skip meant by that, so I'll have to ask him. And then we got an email this week, and it is from Shamok. That's what it says. I'm not sure if that's his real name. But anyways, he says, hi, John. I am listening. I'm continuing to listen to your interviews. Jerry Branum's set of interviews were fabulous. I love the comparison talk. It's always fun to compare. And I love the read of Sergio Oliva. That was the article I read a few weeks ago. What a unique guy. I look forward to the women's bodybuilding interviews when they happen, and I'm loving your Legends book. As a future theme, it would be interesting to hear a focus on West Coast bodybuilding from the 60s, or perhaps themes on gym eras or NABBA versus IFBB and Dan Lori's organization. Anyways, keep up the great work. All right. Thank you for that email. I always appreciate getting emails. If you guys want to email me on your thoughts on the show, just do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will read it on the show if you so choose. And then Robert David also wrote on our Bodybuilding Legends page, which is on Facebook, and Robert David said, I love your show. You're really good at interviewing guests. I never miss a show. And Simon Little said, hi, I love the show. I listen every week. It's really interesting stuff, but I'd love to hear more about the diets and training as well from back in the day. The history's great, but I also believe so much diet and training information is being lost. I feel like that needs preserving to many of the greats before they pass away. So yeah, I hear you on that, Simon, and I've been trying to include that with all our interviews as well as talking about their careers. I do try to ask them a little bit about their training and diet. So a couple people have said that, so I'm trying to do that more and more on the show. And you guys know I love movies. I spent the day at the Tampa Theater. If you ever come to Tampa, they have this great theater. I think it was built in 1926. It's over 90 years old, and it's a great theater. And then on Sundays during the summer, they have what's called the Summer Classic. So every Sunday at 3 o'clock, they play an old movie. And today was Jaws from 1975. So I was all excited. I went to see that today. I just got back and went with my friend Eddie, who I work out with at Powerhouse Gym. He's one of the owners. And he brought all his kids, and his kids loved it. His kids are all small. They obviously never saw Jaws before, but they were scared. So it's still a classic. It was a great movie. And then last week, I saw the Marilyn Monroe, Jack Lemmon, and Tony Curtis classic, Some Like It Hot. So that was great, too. It's just great seeing these movies in a packed theater, and the theater today was packed. All right. So anyways, that's what I'm up to. After our interview today with Skip Robinson, I'm going to read another article, and it's again from Muscle Builder and Power Magazine. This was actually the cover story. It's called Confessions of a Girl Who Loves Muscle Men. It was in the April 1977 issue. It's got a great arm shot of Lou Ferrigno on the cover. It says the incredible 22-inch arm of Lou Ferrigno. But right below that, it says Confessions of a Girl Who Loves Muscle Men. So this was written by Janet Charlton. And if you can remember, about a month ago, I read an article about the Pumping Iron premiere in New York, and Janet wrote that. So this was an interesting article. You guys are going to really love it. She talks about, she's a writer for a lot of the big magazines, and she wrote a couple articles for Muscle Builder. And this was pretty interesting because this was in the 70s. And at the time, there weren't a lot of bodybuilders around, and it wasn't a normal thing to work out. So if you saw a guy with muscles, it was really an unusual thing. And so she talks about most of the guys she's dated at the time who were kind of skinny disco type guys. And then she got to meet Arnold at a party and she started writing articles about bodybuilders. So it's really a pretty interesting article. So I'm going to read that as soon as we finish up our interview with John Lloyd. And before we get to that interview, I also want to mention that we're brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So you can call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939. Or if it's easier, just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. And if you tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you a free consultation, plus they will give you 20% off your order. And they also have a new product called the Magic Pill. It is developed and backed by science. It's a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. It's a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So a month's supply of this amazing fat loss pill and thermogenic is $39.99, and you can just call Florida Alternative Medicine at 813-922-8939 and order your supply. Or just, again, go to their website, flalternativemeds.com. All right, so that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with John Lloyd, where he talks about bodybuilding in the late 70s, early 80s in California. You're really going to love it. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my special guest this week is John Lloyd. John was a bodybuilder in the California area, and he won the Gold's Classic back in 1982. So he is going to be here to talk to us about some of his old bodybuilding stories. How are you doing, John?
Doing good, John. Thanks.
Glad to have you on the show. A lot of people may know your son, Boston, because he's achieved a certain level of fame today. But they may not realize that his dad was a bodybuilder. So I remember you, John, from reading the magazines, and you were in a lot of the Muscle Digest magazines from a lot of those California shows.
Right. Yeah, that was back in the, my first show was late 79 and then just competed through the first part of the 80s and to the middle of the 80s, and I had my injury, and
okay.
My competitive career pretty much ended then.
Oh, I see. Okay. So were you born in California, John?
No, I was born and raised in Spokane, Washington.
When did you move out to California?
So I came out to California in the fall of 76.
Okay.
On a wrestling scholarship to Long Beach.
Oh, okay. Cool. And were you lifting weights back then in high school?
Yeah, I pretty much lifted steady from seventh grade on.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Track and field got me started.
Okay, I see. So when you started lifting weights, it was just as an athlete, then you weren't really thinking about bodybuilding or anything like that?
No, I always had a love for training. I immediately after I started fooling around with the weight for sports, I just fell in love with the pump the results and the body change, and of course the strength that goes along with it.
Yeah,
and then I was one of those kind of obsessed guys in the gym, even when I shouldn't have been working out after a long wrestling practice. I would hit their little gym. Back in those days, we had like a universal gym and some free weights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would stay until the janitor shut the lights out in high school. still working out.
So what sports were you in, John? You were in track and field and wrestling?
I was a three-sport guy in high school.
Okay.
Yeah, I did football, wrestling, and track and field. And then in college, just wrestled through college.
So what college did you go to?
I went to North Idaho Junior College up in Coeur d'Alene for my 2 years. We were a wrestling powerhouse up there, and then transferred to Long Beach State.
Okay, I see. So what was the scene like back then in the 70s? A lot of people today may not understand it, but there really weren't a lot of gyms around back then, right? I mean, weightlifting was not a big deal.
No, not at all. In fact, my second year at Long Beach, I went this summer, I went to Garden Grove and signed up at this Garden Grove Athletic Club because there was so few gyms around.
Yeah.
And I, you know, the facilities at the school weren't really that great and stuff. And so I wanted more. So, yeah, it's, I signed up there. That's where I met Rod Koontz. Rod Koontz was actually training in this little athletic club in Garden Grove.
Oh,
and
okay.
And he opened up a little gym just down the street with some partners called California Gym in Westminster. And that's where I kind of got the old bug. And then so my wrestling career kind of came to an end there, you know, after my injury and my last college wrestling season. Then I first got into powerlifting. I was more of a power bodybuilder in the beginning. Rod trained real heavy. And I went into 79. Rod talked me into going to 79 Ironman, which is in San Jose. Mm-hmm. All Love sponsored that. That was back in that day. The Ironman was half of the judging was powerlifting the first half of the day. And then you did your posing routine.
Oh, wow.
At night. So I went in at 237. I had like a 1785 total. And then I won that Ironman. That was 79. That was December of 79. So that was my launch. And I never, never forget Paul Love when he gave me the trophy at the end of the competition. He says, do yourself a favor. He says, there's no glory in powerlifting. You should stick to bodybuilding. You have good potential in bodybuilding. And so I kind of migrated over pretty much. Well, Rod was trying to talk me into getting more into bodybuilding. I was so naive though, John. I was like, I said, John, I have too much body hair for bodybuilding. And he says, you numbskull. He goes, I'm going to bring you some magazines in. So he brought some Iron Man magazines. He says, these guys shave, you dummy.
You thought they were just like that, huh? And how old were you? How old were you in 79, John?
So in 79, I was 23.
Okay, 23. So tell me a little bit about Rod Koontz, because I heard about him in the magazines, and I think I've seen him compete, like, at the Mr. International. But he was a pretty big, strong guy, huh?
So Rod was, you know, he almost had, like, two sets of different genetics, his upper body and his legs.
Yeah.
But he was super powerful. And Rod would do, like, crazy, he's the one that got me into front squats. We would do our workouts with 500 pounds on front.
Jeez.
And he was real strong in the lats and the biceps too. So he was really my mentor, and he trained heavy. So we were training together there for a while in 77 and 78 and even in 79 a little bit. And then he was a form guy. I was, you know, he really knew his training, and he loved the comedy. He loved the dumbbell work, and he trained heavy, and he's the one that really showed me how to structure the workouts. Because I was a guy, I would just come in and hit all body parts, or I would just, you know, be like, you know, squatting and deading and doing you know, heavy military presses in the same workout and just doing stuff like that. But he really helped me as far as structuring, and then. You know, we got in some really, really incredible workouts, and I always had the work ethic because of my wrestling and my sports background. I was always a hard worker in the gym, but
yeah,
he combined that intensity with weight. I just assumed that, well, bodybuilders are all strong, you know.
Yeah,
he was strong. I mean, we're talking like, you know, we would finish up on preachers, for instance, with you know, your cambered bar with 45s and a couple 10s or a quarter on each side.
Yeah.
You know, and then he would do like heavy, like French presses and flies. And you know, he was just, yeah. So I got that. That was a good start. And, but yeah, his form was impeccable.
500 on front squats. That's huge, especially for back then.
Yeah. And we really got into the heavy fronts. In fact, I really didn't back squat all that much. I mean, it was obviously in the powerlifting event. I did a couple powerlifting events, but my front squat was pretty close to my back squat.
Wow. And you had good legs, right, John, from what I remember from the pictures?
Yeah, more legs. Legs and lats were probably my better body parts.
Okay.
Know? My legs were always, my legs were pretty good.
Yeah, from what I remember, you had that big sweep on your legs. You had the real good quads.
Yeah, my leg, I always train my legs hard, and just genetically, I mean, you know all about that. Mm-hmm. You got some fantastic shape. You know, you got those big flaring quads yourself, you know. So
I didn't know Rod had a gym back then.
So it wasn't really. So what it was is because of his title. Because this, when I met Rod, literally it was just a few months after he won his USA title, because he won in '77.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what happened is he managed it. They talked him into using his name and kind of putting reputation behind their gym, because Rod didn't have any funds to really start his own gym. And so that worked out for a while, but it didn't really last very long. And he ended up doing kind of his own thing after that, because it kind of fizzled out with the partnership. So the gym in Westminster wasn't there that long, probably 2 years max. And that's where I met Ed Connors. Ed Connors was a friend with Rod, and Ed came in one evening, and that's what changed my whole path of my career. Because that night when I met Ed, we kept in contact, and I was going to coach and teach, because I was a phys ed major. Back then it was phys ed, not kinesiology, and I was going to coach and teach. And Ed offered me the job, along with Bob Reese, 79 in US, Mr. USA, to go manage and run the very first San Francisco licensed gym.
And he
bought a gym called Diamond Gym in San Francisco, and we changed the name to Goals, and that started the whole Goals Gym franchise. That was summer of 1980. So that was a switch up right there, because I was going to, like I said, I was going to do something completely different. I ended up getting in the gym business for 20 years.
No kidding. Wow. No kidding. I didn't know that. And you said Bob Reese was out there too. He was from Wisconsin originally, right?
Yeah, Bob was from Wisconsin, but he was out here, and you know, he had, of course, Ed Connors he had a knack. He would find these bodybuilders, and you know, Ed had this mission, you know, to start the Gold's Gym franchise and licensee throughout the country, and he would hire these bodybuilders that wanted to go to work in the gym and offer them, because what he would do, Ed he offered people to, you know, work hard and be loyal to the gym. And help with the, you know, getting new locations going. He would let us buy shares, percentages of the gym based on what he originally capitalized the gym. So you could actually become a pretty substantial partner after working. So that's what happened with me after I got my injury and ended in my career as far as bodybuilding ended in the mid 80s. I had decided, you know, I want to do this as a career, as far as, you know, I just love the gym and the passion and all that. So,
yeah.
And there was many people that actually Ed Connors influenced because of his generosity and of his position with the gym, the Gold's Gym name, got their launch as far as, you know, I could go on, Rick Stevenson with San Diego. That was all because from Ed. You know, there's a lot of guys that got their start that way in the gym business.
So the first Gold's Gym franchise then was right around that time, 1980, you said?
Actually, June 16th of 1980, we opened up the Gold's Gym in San Francisco. And so my second show, that weekend, June 14th, was the Western America. And I went in. I wasn't peaked, but I went in the show. I took second to heavyweight, and then the following Monday we opened up. Yeah, Bob was there, and we were there. I was there for 4 years before I moved back down to Southern California.
Tell me a little bit about Bob Reese, because being from Chicago, I've seen him compete in some Midwest shows and stuff. You know, like the regional level shows. But I always remember him. He was a big, thick guy, big chest, big arms.
Now, John, that guy was a beast in the gym, but he had at least when I, the years I knew Bob, I mean, he must have put something together nutritionally structured for him to be able to get in the kind of condition he did to win that USA. But when I knew Bob, I mean, this guy was so powerful, it was scary, some of the stuff he would do in the gym. And he was like on chocolate milk and donuts. I mean, the guy was unbelievable. You know, he'd eat. When he'd eat, he'd scarf the food down, but he was sick. I mean, he would do a couple of the most phenomenal things that I've never seen, never will see it ever again. He would take 150 dumbbells. He'd warm up a little bit, he'd do dips with a 150 strap to his waist, kind of like guys do with their body weight.
Yeah.
And part of his tricep workout, he would take the 150s, and he, you know, warm up with, you know, whatever, 80s and 100s, 120s. He would go to 150s, and he would do a semi-strict, like you would do with a cambered bar, as mm-hmm. far as lying tricep extensions to the forehead. He would come down on a flat bench with the 150s and do like a tricep extension.
Holy shit.
No, wow. No, it was like, it was beyond. And he'd come to the gym at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, no breakfast, whatever, you know, come in there, we'd open six, and he would warm up with 315 on the bench.
Oh,
and
man.
He would just do 10s and 12s with 495, remember that, five plates, and would have that little sweet jingle at the top, you know, just like real mm-hmm. controlled reps, and yeah, wow. massive chest and big arms.
Yeah. I had no idea it was that powerful. I mean, like I said, I just remember seeing pictures of him in all those regional level and national level shows.
Yeah, Bob was very impressive in the gym.
Hmm. Wow. Whatever happened to him? Yeah. What's he doing now? Do you know?
You know what? The last I heard with Bob, he was in Central California.
Okay.
And this is years ago, and he was working in the oil fields. And that's the last, I don't know. I've tried to look Bob up, and I've never been able to locate him.
How old do you think he would be now?
See, when I met Bob, so I was 25, and Bob was like probably 29. So Bob would be like around the 67 years old.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, he came close to winning the America a few times, but he never quite did it.
Right.
He always had that thickness, though, but like you said, he didn't really have the condition. He wasn't really ripped.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. And his legs were a little behind, but, you know, like
yeah.
you know, even his legs, you know, he would squat with decent weight and stuff, but his leg workouts were not the same as his upper body. He was just, you know, just very strong and a lot of movements, you know, brought mm-hmm. out some major quality in his upper body. His leg workouts were not the same. He didn't treat his legs the same as his upper body.
Yeah, yeah. Who else were you guys attracting into the gym back then in San Francisco?
So in those days, so Don Ross would come from the East Bay, and he'd train with us. He'd train over
okay.
there. That was his kind of his favorite gym. Don Ross would come in there, and you know, he was a real character. Everybody liked to have Don. Yeah, he was
yeah.
a good guy.
Yeah.
And then as far as competitive bodybuilders back in those days, up there, nobody that ever, I don't think ever did anything nationally up there. Charles Francois, but he didn't. There was just a few guys, but not that many guys competitive as far as big shows up there, John.
Okay. Yeah, Don Ross, he loved bodybuilding, didn't he? He was so passionate about it.
Oh, my gosh, Don was – he had the same enthusiasm when he would talk about bodybuilding and training. I was, you know, talking about those guys and stuff, and he would get so excited. He was like – I don't know if you ever met Jack LaLanne, but Jack LaLanne,
oh, yeah.
he was
yeah.
– even his later years, John, did you ever talk to Jack LaLanne about
– Oh, yeah, yeah, nutrition? I met him a few times. Yep.
Mm-hmm. How excited he gets. He kind of froths at the mouth a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. His wife, Jack LaLanne's wife, said, oh, that's because he has 100 different supplements that he blends in the morning. She was like on Venice Beach at one of the shows at the Pit one year. She was explaining why he was – Yeah, it was so funny. But Don Ross was the same. He was so pumped with bodybuilding.
Right.
He loved it. He just loved it.
There was a thing on ESPN once when they used to cover bodybuilding in the early 90s, and it was the year that Flex Wheeler won the USA, and they got Don to do the expert commentary with some guy from ESPN, and they were just introducing the show. And Don started talking about Flex Wheeler, and he was getting so excited. It was like he was a wrestler. You know, he was like sure. getting so excited. This guy
oh,
was
yeah.
like backing away from him. It was so
yeah, yeah,
funny.
Yeah. That's
do you remember
that's
that?
Exactly what he would do. That's exactly Don's personality.
Oh my God.
You know,
so
and
hilarious.
His life, he went too young. His heart attack got him at 48, poor guy.
Wow. He's that young.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Unbelievable. So yeah. you did the California in 81, and that was MPC already, right? They were starting the MPC?
So 81, that's funny you bring up 81. So 81, I met, so Lance Dreher, you know, did Lance win the America in 81 or 83, 81, I think.
81, yeah.
He won, well,
he won the
before.
Heavyweights, and Belknap won the overall.
Yeah, Belknap, well, yeah. Anyway, so Lance Dreher came up one weekend. We had, you know, when we didn't have regulars, but we had guys flying that would, you know, work out. So Lance Dreher was there. So Lance had a really slow metabolism, right? And so back then I didn't, at 81, I just was starting to get into being able to fine tune my body, but I really still didn't hit on what my body most needed and just the calorie wise and all that to get in my best condition.
Right.
And so I was still experimenting in 81. So early 81, Lance Dreher came and we talked and stuff, and he went over his diet. So Lance was, so for him, he had a slow metabolism. He had to take in like 1400 calories, 1600 Jeez. Calories a day to get in shape.
Wow.
And I've always had a fast metabolism. So like a dummy. So I think, you know what, maybe that's my thing. Maybe I can't get shredded unless I just really, really sacrifice and punish myself with low calories. Well, like a dummy, so I, maybe being an overworker, so I did that for like the last 4 weeks with 81 cal. It was like May of 81. I did that, and then I went ahead, besides my workouts, I was running stairs because I lived up in the hills and stuff. I was running stairs, riding my 10 feet up and down hills and stuff, and I went in like a stinking basketball player in that show, like 100, I think I went at 225. The 81 cal and took fifth.
I'll tell you, John.
At that time, I was 6'2".
Okay.
I'm shy under 6'1" now. You know, I got
I
call the accordion. I have the accordion physique now. All the years squatting and deadlifting.
That's right.
So then in 82, I gave it another shot. You know, I won the heavyweight, but 82, I did the Gold Classic was 4 weeks for the cal. And that's when Mike Christian was making his comeback. So he was in the Gold Classic, and then 4 weeks later was the Cal.
Now in the Cal in 82, that was a pretty big lineup. You won the heavyweights, and in the light heavyweights, Bob Harris was second to John Jordan. I remember John Jordan, the black guy. He had a good physique.
He did. I just looked up John Jordan the other day, and he's still around training.
Is he really?
He looks good.
No kidding. Good. Wow. And J.J. Marsh was in fourth place. Frank Grieco was the middleweight winner.
Oh, wow. You did your research, Sean.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the internet. I'm cheating.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there was. That was a stacked lineup. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So that had to be a good win for you, huh? Well, back then, the California was a big – that was a big title. That was one of the biggest titles in the country, really.
Well,
everybody knew who Mr. California was. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right about that. I remember, when Rory won in 80, and there was a huge, there was so much depth in that heavyweight class when he won that. That was very impressive. And
in my opinion, Rory
still, I think that when he won the Cal in 80, I think that's the best he ever looked.
Really? Wow.
I think so when I look back.
Is that the one where they took the pictures of him outside? Was it Joe Valdez took those pictures where he had the skull cap on or whatever.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He did look phenomenal there.
I don't think he ever looked better. That was summer of 80.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, John Brown was in there. I want to say it was John Arnitas. You just did a thing on John Arnitas, right? I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We just interviewed him today.
I think who's the guy that won the America that lives up in Fresno now? What's his name?
The Gary Leonard.
Gary Leonard.
Yeah,
I think Gary Leonard was in it too, right? In 80.
Yeah, he was from California.
Yeah, it was stacked.
And then that Gold's Classic in 82, like you said, you beat Christian. You got third, and you got first.
Yeah, Christian, I beat Christian there, and there was a kid, Youngblood, who ended up winning the universe in the middle. He won the middleweight class.
James Youngblood, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember back in the day, if you won the nationals, or back then it was the Mr. America. Then you represented the USA and the universe.
Yeah, yeah. And you had to do that in order to get your pro card.
Right.
And Tim Smolinski won the light heavyweights. I remember him from Rockford, Illinois. I seen him compete many times when I was living in Chicago.
From back east.
Yeah.
He was from back east, yes.
He had a great physique, too. Real symmetrical, like a Frank Zane type, you know.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think now, just getting off the subject for a second, John, about how they give so many pro cards today compared to how – I mean, I was thinking about that when I did that interview with John Arneda. Like, wow, this guy had a phenomenal physique. And he actually won his class at the USA, and he still never got his pro card.
See, John, I mean, of course, Boston, he keeps me up on that stuff. And he's, he just can't even take the politics as far as what – But he, it's embarrassing to me. I mean, looking at like you're mentioning these physiques back in our day, you know, in the 70s and 80s that they couldn't become pro, and seeing what's going on now in today's bodybuilding world, or so many divisions, I don't even know the names of all the different divisions now, but all these pro cards are being issued. First, second, and third in some of these shows, or first and second?
First and second, classes? At least, yeah. At the Nationals, I know it's first and second, yeah.
But not just the overall, like in each individual class, I think.
Right, each class, right. Mm-hmm.
So it's so watered down that where's the nostalgia? Where's the...
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, it's a shame.
Well, I remember, like back in the 80s, I remember, you know, when the Nationals would come up, it was like everybody in the country knew who was going in it. You know, we knew that it was going to be Liedemeyer, Paris, Christian, Mendenhall. I mean, we all knew the big names, you know, and it was only one guy would get it. And then the next year, all those other guys would come back again. So it was just like, it was just an all-star lineup. You know, those guys were all famous. You know, we all knew them.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And back, see, what I'm starting to think now, like even in the Nationals in the USA, it was at 82 or 83, John, where it switched from AAU America to the MPC Nationals.
82.
So when Gary Stridham beat me and won the heavyweight class in the 84 USA, he lost the overall to Phil Williams. I don't even think he got a pro card for that, did he?
No, Phil Williams didn't either. Phil Williams won the overall.
Phil Williams had to get it. He won the overall, right?
No, they didn't start that till 87 when Mike Quinn won it.
Oh, so only the Nationals.
Right, yeah. The Nationals.
Oh,
and,
I forgot about that.
And it wasn't even just the Nationals. You had to go to the Universe and win the Universe, even if you won the Nationals. Because remember, Phil Williams won the overall at the 85 Nationals, and then he went to the Universe and he got beat by Joseph Romulus. So he didn't turn pro. He didn't turn pro for 3 years.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Can you imagine? He beat out Labrada, and he beat out Ron Love for the overall, and then Ron Love and Labrada the next year went to the Night of the Champions, and they competed. They took first and second, and Phil sat out. He just didn't do it. Here's a guy who won the overall at the USA and the Nationals, and he didn't get his pro card.
So
I mean, eventually he did, but back then he didn't. You know,
that is just robbery compared to what's going on these days. To me, it's bodybuilding and what are these other divisions? I guess it's physique and. So what's the one with the board shorts? Men's fitness or
men's physique?
Men's physique. I mean, it's a promoter's world now. It's the athlete. It's way too watered down. And you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess there's some really good physiques that win the men's physique. But you know, the emphasis doesn't have to be nearly is geared towards leg training anymore, right? Because
their legs are covered up.
They're covered up, and so unfortunately, the bodybuilding how we knew it and what we, you know, the sport that we loved and were so addicted to, it just unfortunately nothing lasts. Nothing seems to last, and certainly the days of bodybuilding. That we can look back and have these great memories about it's just never be again.
Yeah, like you said, a lot of them got really great physiques, phenomenal physiques. But you know, the thing I don't like about it is there's no posing, so they just come out there and stand there. And that was one of the joys of bodybuilding back in the day, was seeing the posing. You know.
Oh, and there was some incredible posers. I mean,
yeah,
I just saw the other day. I don't know if you may have put it on with the Sean Ray's routine back in one of his national shows. I mean, there was so many good. Rory Liedemeyer. Well, Rory actually, John Arneda, I believe, got his posing from Rory.
Yeah.
And others too, because Rory, that was his forte. But yeah, there was some tremendous, even my old roommate, Barry Clothier, he was kind of like a Rory protege as far as his posing routine. He was really good, very entertaining. Yeah, so you don't see that nowadays.
Yeah, I just talked to John Arneta about that when I did the interview with him, and he would say, you know, for 8 weeks before the show, you would work on it every day. That was part of your workout. You'd spend like at least an hour, and then you'd put it to music, and you really made sure that posing was as good as you could make it, you know?
Yeah, that reminds me, in 70, for my, okay, I did the Orange County. So I did the Orange County in May of 80, just before we left for San Francisco.
Okay.
And my good friend, Wayne DePlantis, he was a sales manager at Worthington Ford. That was one of my part-time jobs, selling cars for him. But anyway, so he's from Louisiana, so he was really good friends with Boyer Coe.
Yeah.
So I got a chance to, you know, I became friends with Boyer Coe. Boyer Coe actually trained also out at the Fountain Valley World that Don Howard had. And anyway, so I got tied in with Boyer Coe back then, just because I was just this young guy in bodybuilding. Here's Boyer Coe, right? So he comes over, him and Wayne, right? Great friends and stuff. So he actually worked with me like three different times down in Wayne's basement on the compulsories.
Oh, really? And, wow.
Yeah, I was treated to that, and he actually had a lot of good stuff that he showed me, a lot of good points. He brought up that Rod didn't really go over with me to that extent. So I was really thankful about that.
What did he show you? Do you remember? Like certain tips?
It was just, you know, he was showing me some stuff about, like, you know, the transitions of going from, you know, the compulsories, like, say, for instance, going from a lat spread to a double bicep, to a side chest, to a side tricep, but having the transitional flow in between.
Yeah.
You know, with the arm coming out and kind of making it look more artistic.
Yeah.
You know, a couple things with my back posing, where I could do some variations and have one arm down and one arm up with the hand open. And he showed me some kind of cool stuff, you know, that I would never probably have done.
Wow, what a treat, huh? To be taught posing by Boyer Coe.
It was. Yes.
Yeah, he's one of the most down-to-earth friendly guys I've ever interviewed. He was just so open and so friendly.
Oh,
and
such a sweet guy.
And very honest, too.
Oh, yeah, no, totally, completely honest and down-to-earth. Just a bedrock nature. That guy's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. He's still doing good, too. He's older now, but he's still doing good.
Yeah, last time I saw him, unfortunately, was at Dennis's funeral.
Oh,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So what were some of the other guys you met around that time, John? Like you said, Stridham. Did you know Stridham at all? You competed with him in 84.
Gary, there was controversy that weekend if he should have been competing at all because of the South African.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't a citizen, and he was allowed to compete. But every time we talked that day, of course, and that night, and congratulated him and all that. It was a 1 point deal. You know, he got 4 points, I got three. But it was, you know, it could have, you know, he was 222, I was 244.
Wow.
But I had a double breakfast like a dummy. I overspilled a little bit. I made up for it as the prejudging was concluded. It had us up there forever. And I knew I could feel it. I was getting sharper, losing some water as we were posing, but obviously it wasn't enough. But he was very friendly, very outgoing. And every time I ever saw Gary after that or talked with him, he's always been such a really sweet guy, you know, real pleasant.
Yeah, you guys both had the good legs, because he had good legs even back then, right, in 84. He wasn't as good in 84 as he was in 86, but...
No, but I'll tell you with Gary. So the thing with Gary, so arms down, most muscular.
Yeah.
He had me. Arms down, most muscular shots, he had me. But where I thought I could get the edge on him is because my lats and his lack of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that could edge it, but I obviously was too spilled over, probably a little bit too much water in the beginning of the prejudging to make up for that. But nothing had taken from him because he had really a tremendous physique.
Did you remember Phil Williams from that show? The guy who won the overall.
I don't think I talked to Phil, but yeah, of course I remember him.
Yeah.
And Phil then, John, do you remember a guy named Bronson Austin?
Yeah, he was from the Illinois area too, so I saw him compete too.
So that Western America I told you about in the summer of 80 in the Bay Area, Bronson Austin's the one that won that overall.
And then he went to the America that year, right? He won the light heavyweight class.
He did.
Yeah. And then he got second to Johnny Fuller at the Universe.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah, he had a great Johnny physique. Not that big, but really rock hard and great biceps.
Oh, yeah, and his abs were sick, too.
Yeah. I don't know if you ever heard that story, I guess. So he wins the Nationals in the light heavyweight class, and then he's on the American team, and he goes over to the Universe, and Johnny Fuller beats him from England. And so he doesn't get his pro card. So then in 81, they had a pro-am show. I think they were trying it for the first time, where they had amateurs and pros competing together, and he went in it. And I think he got, like, second or third in the pros, competing against the pros. Yeah. And they offered him a pro card, and he said, no, I'm going to do the Universe again. So he went and did the Universe again, and he turned it down. He never got his pro card after that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he got third. I'm looking at it now. He got third place. Called the Grand Prix World Cup. So Boyer won. Chris Dickerson got second. He got third, and Johnny Fuller, who beat him at the Universe, got fourth. And they offered him a pro card because he got third, and he turned it down. And then he went to the America that year. He got fourth, so he was done.
Ah, he missed out on it.
Yeah.
That stinks. Oh, man.
So who were some of the other guys you remember, John, around that time? Because that was a great time in bodybuilding, early 80s.
So do you want to hear a funny story about Mike Mentzer?
Sure. Yeah, I love Mike Mentzer stories.
All right, so, you know, Mike Mentzer. You know that kind of that famous picture in front of Gold's Gym, John? It was shot in October of 80. It's got, you know, Lou Frigno's in the front. You got the Mentzers. You got all these guys in front of.
Yeah.
It was the old Gold's location when it was in Santa Monica, right?
Yeah, the big group shot.
Right. So, you know, that was summer of 80. I just gotten into bodybuilding and started working for Gold's Gym in San Francisco. And we actually flew down for that picture. It was kind of exciting weekend stuff. So there was a guy named Denny Malloy.
Yeah.
Denny Malloy was actually co-manager with the gym that Ed ended up buying. That was that Diamond Gym. But anyway, so that weekend he was down there, and he was training. He was, never forget it, he was training laps with Mike and Ray.
Okay.
And they were doing heavy, you know, all the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Heavy pull downs, weighted chins, heavy barbell rows, seated cable rows.
Uh-huh.
And I think, was Lyle Alzado also there? I think Lyle was also there. Anyway, heavy duty. So now fast forward. So we take the picture. So fast forward to the Northern California Championships in 1981.
Okay.
That Ed Connors hired Mike Mentzer to guest pose.
All right.
And this is like March of 81. So this is from, this is like 6 months in between, right?
Okay.
So I don't know if you ever read, but they had a book to joke around, the muscle confusion principle, like get big, muscle confusion. And what they were touting was, and pushing was, like, all you need in the gym is 20 minutes. 20 minutes of balls to the walls, you know, forced reps, negative reps.
Yeah.
You know, and just hit it hard, leave it alone, and go to the next body part, right?
Yeah.
And they were doing really well with the sales of these books and this whole concept, because it's Mike Mentzer, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he had the day after the show, he did a seminar in our gym, and he was pushing that whole concept. And I, you know, all these, of course, these kids and stuff like that, I mean, I never, you know, someone from my background and all that, you know, I know that how important it is to warm the muscle up to, you know, to graduate into these heavyweights. And it was really, to me, it was a very injurious method, especially to take a guy that, you know, is just maybe not so mature with the muscle mass and trying to get into this heavy, intense, forced and negative reps without proper warmth, and, you know, and then just hitting it that hard for like two or three sets, and that's it.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I questioned him. I said, but Mike, in all due respect, I just saw you guys, because we teach, you know, like four or five sets of different exercises per body part, mm-hmm. you know, four to five exercises. And that I saw you guys go through a whole workout similar to what, you know, everybody is pretty much the norm of how we train if we're really, you know, serious about putting on mass. And so what are you saying? Is this like a part of the whole spectrum, like just a certain like few weeks before a show or in the very off season? Could you explain like when, because it, obviously you don't train like this all the time.
Yeah.
And so he kind of did a qualification of it where no, you can't always train this way. You know, you've got to go in cycles where you have different methods of set of your reps and sets and, mm-hmm. and graduating up in weights and all that. It's not always doing forced and negative type repetitions, but it was interesting that it was obviously for selling and all that. But you know, Mike, most of the people that we met in all those days of my days in the 70s and 80s, you know, were always really like, it seemed like they were down to earth and helpful. Mike was one personality where I really felt that he was very condescending,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't, you know, he was, you know, I don't think he treated people really that well.
Wow.
I don't know if it was an ego thing or whatever, but yeah, I always said then he had problems after that, as you know, with the Weider organization and all that. But it was very, very sad what ended up happening to him and his brother so young.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. Especially very for sad. Someone who was such a big superstar in the 70s.
Oh yeah, they went so close together, it was just sick.
Yeah, yeah. How did he look when he guest posed?
Boy, he looks phenomenal.
Did he? Yeah.
He had that marbly muscle, just that, you know, didn't never, you know, even though his chest wasn't, you know, that huge, he had that Herculean shape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, he was probably 80% that okay. weekend, you know, mm-hmm. of his norm, but he looked pretty phenomenal.
So that was after the 80 Olympia. Was he planning on retiring then, or was it still up in the air if he looked that good still?
Yeah, but John, I don't know. I can't remember how long his competitive career lasted after that, but isn't that when he took fifth and he had that whole problem with Weider after that?
Yeah, he took fifth at the 80 Olympia.
Yeah.
So and he never competed after that.
He thought he should have won.
Right.
And he actually got physical with Joe in the office in Woodland Hills.
Did he really? Wow.
He did. He was blackballed. He got blackballed.
No kidding. Wow.
No, because he really felt he was robbed. And
yeah.
He was done. He thought he put everything on the table for that one, left nothing out. And he still felt he got royally screwed over. And he said, yeah, I'm sure he justified in his mind, you know, I don't even care anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not doing, you know, if I can't do better than fifth, then I know I can't prepare myself any more than I did. I'm done. You know, I'm sure that's similar to that.
Especially since he was so close the year before to Zane, he got second in his very first Olympia.
Yeah.
I think it was because Arnold beat him too. I think he didn't like
well,
Arnold.
Well, not only that, John, but look at let's face it. Look at how, I mean, Arnold, but look at how he looked that year.
Yeah.
Look at how Arnold looked that year. Look at his legs that year.
Right, I know. Did you ever see Arnold out there training?
Never, ever have seen Arnold in the gym training. I've seen Lou several times, but never Arnold.
Yeah. And when you saw Lou, was that when he was doing the Hulk thing?
Yeah. Rod and I went into Venice one day, one evening, and met Joe Gold, and Lou was in there. That was like 77. Yeah,
okay.
77. And so I'm one-time training back in that day. But the whole Hulk thing came later than that, but he was still... But in 77, I think, what year was the Pumping Iron film? That was like in
75. Yeah.
So he was peaked out. But I tell you something, I don't know if you ever saw that movie, Hercules movie with Lou.
Yeah, yeah.
What one of those, as far as the movie goes, you'd walk out if you didn't,
right.
if, if Lou wasn't in the condition, he was in phenomenal condition.
Oh, God, he looked unbelievable in that movie.
That's the only reason I sat through it. I go, right. He's in some sick condition. I can't leave.
I wonder how he would have did in the Olympia if he would have went in like that.
Oh.
God, he was amazing.
He was.
How about Platts? Did you ever get to see him?
Gosh, I wanted to see one of his legs. I never saw
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
I wanted to witness his leg workout.
Yeah, because around that time, that's when all the – well, I guess most of those guys were at the original Gulch, right, in Santa Monica.
They were not. One guy, I'll tell you, you know, I caught just the two guys I got to tell you real quick about that were – when we took over the Northridge Gulch in December of 88 was Bertel Fox and Albert Beckles.
Oh, okay.
So Bertel, they actually had – so that we had one, you know – weights, dumbbells graduated 150s, but Bertel, there was a set of 187 and a half that they set up for him.
187 and a half.
Now, John, I've never in my life seen, okay, I told you about Bob Reese with that tricep extension.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
But never have I seen a man make the 180s. I've never even seen the 187s on a dumbbell in my life before that anyway. But never did I ever thought I could, could make that heavy of a dumbbell on a flat bench look like it's like a repetition workout weight.
Wow, unbelievable.
He was so strong on those flats.
Wow.
And then, you know, just to get those suckers up, you know, and have them rest on your knees, you know,
yeah,
go back.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was really, but he wasn't there long with us. He was just there for a few months.
Okay.
But Albert Beckles was there for a while. And then he went to North Hollywood. In fact, Albert's still at North Hollywood Gold.
Is he really? Wow.
Yeah. Genetically, Albert Beckles, his skin is like a baby's. It's like a baby's butt. I mean, this guy's got the most incredible genetically gifted skin. This guy.
Yeah, the guy always just seems so rock hard all the time, no matter how old he was. You know.
Man.
We have a TV in the back of the Powerhouse Athletic Club where I train in Tampa, and I got some old videos, and I made them into DVDs, and I brought them up to the gym. So they play them continuously, and one of them was the 88 Olympia, and Albert's in that, and I think he's 50 in that, and he looks just phenomenal. Like, his back and his biceps are just so rock hard, you know, such quality muscle.
Oh, my gosh. And then back in that – okay, so then – okay, I got to tell you about somebody else. Okay, so it's all coming back. So now there's a gym in the East Bay in Alameda called Iron Island.
Okay.
Iron Island. I don't know if you ever heard of a guy named Lee Moran, but that's where Lee
yeah.
Moran
Powerful,
trained.
Yeah.
He was a record holder of the squat for a while, right?
Yeah.
He passed early, but that's where he trained. But also Robbie Robinson trained there, the Black
okay.
Prince.
Uh-huh.
And they had some really barbaric, it was like this, talk about a dark dungeon.
Yeah.
It was, Iron Island was a perfect name for this place, right?
It sounds like a prison.
But yeah. But Robbie, it looked like one, but just wait. But Robbie Robinson was where he trained. I don't know if he trained there all the time, but I did catch him there one day, and you know, he was just we're talking about rock solid muscularity.
Yeah,
this guy was wild. This
yeah.
guy is really incredible looking.
And Robbie's pretty strong too, right?
You know, they told me some of the stuff that he does. In fact, they had a seated cable roll machine. They customized a seated cable row was a 400 pounder.
Wow.
I know he did reps with that.
Holy
you know,
cow.
He was,
wow.
Yeah, he wasn't weak, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, Lee Moran, he was the guy that was squatting and then he would get the nosebleeds, right?
John, this guy was he was a walking heart attack. So what he would do, John, he couldn't lace his shoes. So there was a Chinese restaurant across the street. Everybody knew about this. He would have his the buffet,
uh-huh.
and purposely when he had a heavy double or max day on the squat,
yeah,
because it was because of the shock absorber effect off of the gut,
right,
place his shoes and the guy
yeah.
it was then one time he came into the Walnut Creek Gold's gym that we had over there with Steve O'Brien. Steve and I were partners in the Walnut Creek Gold's. And he came over there one night on his bench day, and he had just getting up to go to get a drink of water and coming back to the bench. And he was, I think he was working out with 585 to 600 that day, but his breathing was so scary, and he was bleeding out of his ear and his nose.
Oh my God.
John, it was just a tragedy to see that.
Mm. He died of a heart attack?
I'm not 100%, but yeah. I'm sure it was heart related.
How about some of the new guys, John? Did you see guys like Haney and Gaspari when they were coming along? Well, you competed against Christian in Paris.
So, I just would see those guys when I'd come into Venice for like a quick workout once in a while. And glancing. But those two, actually, Haney and Gaspari both were involved in a gym that was set up in 1983 in San Fernando Valley before they moved to the location that Boston's mom and I ran.
Okay.
The street. They were regulars there.
Was that Reseda? Reseda, California?
That was the Reseda Gold. It was there from 83 to 86. And okay. Prior to the Reseda Gold was Don Peters' gym.
Uh-huh.
You remember a guy named Don Peters?
Yeah. Yeah, he had a real good physique, yeah. Too.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Don Peters' gym.
Yeah, Don Peters.
Anyway,
he was an older
yeah,
guy.
So all those guys, Mendenhall, that's where Mendenhall, that's where Gaspari, that's okay. Where Haney trained, you know, and then they migrated over to Venice and all that later. But, yeah, those guys there.
Did you ever get to see Rachel McLish when she was in her prime?
Okay, John, so let me tell you something right now. Rachel, okay, I only saw her one time.
Okay.
And I'm a lake. I'm a lake guy. I love lake. Okay, so Rachel McLeish, I can't. It wasn't the day of the picture in the old gold in Venice, but it was one. It was some one of the weekends, whatever. I was either whether I was just visiting or because normally when I'd go in there, it would be just to see Ed or after I met Ed and later on. But anyway, so. It was just a regular, just a summer day, and I look and I go, holy smokes, that's Rachel McLeish. And she had the most beautiful bronze, tanned, hard, perfectly feminine hard, right?
Yeah.
And her glow, she had a glow to her.
Yeah.
And a muscularity that was like perfect.
Yeah,
I mean, as far as femininity and still muscular,
right?
Oh my gosh! Oh, but you know, I forgot to tell you. I forgot to tell you. So besides that, was just a one time thing seeing Rachel McLeish. But Corey Everson was a member in our gym. I forgot to tell you about that.
Oh, okay.
So Corey trained every day with Darcy back in the early the late 80s, early 90s when we had the gym in Northridge.
Mm-hmm.
And with Corey, I didn't even know it was Corey. I said, that's not Corey. They said, that's John. That's Corey. She's here every afternoon. I go, what are you talking about? Because I'm looking, because our gym was known for, we had all these awesome, awesome pictures from Arnold to, Lisa Lyon to all these, pioneers in bodybuilding, Bill Pearl and all these classic shots, stuff that you post all the time. That, by the way, I don't know where you get your library, but I've never seen anybody has access to all the pictures that you do. But anyway, so she Corey, I was at every show I ever saw Corey, she's all glamored out in muscle and fitness.
Yeah.
Right? So she used to wear the old, the baggy pants and the real loose workout top, and kind of mousy brown hair. And I go, oh my gosh, that is Corey. She was there for like 3 or 4 years off and on, and then she was a really good friend with Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan and Brutus Beefcake, they trained in our gym. So they were friends. And then my Boston's mom used to train. Terry Bollea is Hulk's name. She used to train Linda, Terry's ex-wife.
Okay.
And and then Chuck Norris was, Chuck Norris was in our gym.
Really? Wow. That's cool.
So, Boston, Boston was, he got some early martial arts lessons from
really? From Chuck Norris himself.
I posted a few of them. I have posted a few of them on Facebook. Chuck was a good friend of ours.
Wow, that's awesome. Man, I'll tell you, tell me all these stories. It's like it shows how important and how hard everybody trained back then, remember? Just don't see that kind of intensity anymore. It's like the training was always hard from everybody.
It was, and then there was also this gym camaraderie. That's what I really miss.
Yeah, me too.
You know, you'd come in the gym, John, and you know all these characters, or these crazy personalities, and you know they all you throw around the jokes and stuff, but everybody trained like you're saying, so intense.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, and a lot of these guys had some serious strength in their training. You know, they were strong, you know, but the workout intensity and the seriousness of the workout and the nutrition and everything was so rock solid. I really do miss that.
Yeah. You know, I think it was just everybody knew that if you wanted to get big and you wanted to look good, you had to train really, really hard. That was it.
That's it. Yeah. Yep. And Rod was the early instiller of that. Like I said, I had that ethic because I was always the goofy guy, you know, that always did too much in sports and stuff. But it just trickled it all the way through, you know, in the bodybuilding. Because my first experience seeing a really high level bodybuilder to see and how he trained is like, you know what, this is just a switch over from wrestling to bodybuilding. Of course, I always liked my own. I always loved my own training. I mean, I was obsessed. I worked, you know, from freshman year in high school through freshman year in college. Every summer, any construction was for my uncle, and I brought my weights with me every summer. And that doesn't matter how late, how dark it was when we finished work. I would do one body part, but I'd do like 20 sets. And it was just one of those things where early on, you know, like I said, I was fixated and loved the feeling that you got from the weights.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just loved it. And to be able to turn that over and do that for a career for 20 years and my love of bodybuilding, whatever, tie that in with my own competing and personal training and meeting all these different people that were, you know, from all phases, you know, competitors and school that just loved to train and people just wanted to get in shape. And, you know, just that whole, well, I know you're obviously your passion is exact same what I'm talking about.
Right. You know, and right.
I just miss the old days.
So how long did you own the gym for, John?
Well, I had Northern California gyms from, when Ed originally had us be able to buy in the shares from mid-80.
Okay.
From mid-80 to when the last gym we sold was May of 99. So all the way, for those almost 20 years, we had gyms. We had a couple different gyms in San, couple different locations in San Francisco. And then I had the Walnut Creek Golds with Brian, a partner with Steve O'Brien. And then the Northridge with Boston's mom. But all the span was 1980 to 99.
Okay. And you mentioned your injury. What injury did you have after the USA in 84?
So what happened to me, John? So, you know, I was telling you about the heavy training. So what happened, I had a shoulder injury that was a wrestling injury, a nerve injury in my neck that affected my front left delt. I always had to train around that, but that wasn't the debilitating one at the end of my career. So in the middle of 82, actually, no, it was the fall of 82 because it was after the Cal. I used to do power cleans I used to do sets of eight with 365.
Wow.
I was an idiot because why was I still doing power cleans?
Right. Nobody did those.
So, you know, anyway, so I felt heat. I never forget. I felt heat in my right SI joint, my sacroiliac, and that doing those. And that was the beginning of my back problem. Okay. So, so from that point, my back started, I started having issues with my back. And what ended up happening between the USA in 84 and some guest bones in 85, because I wanted to do the 85 USA again. I went and found out that I had, because I was working for the Huntington Beach Golds for a little while, And I went in, I wasn't doing well there, and I didn't like the setup at this gym. So I actually went back into construction, and I was actually plastering houses, driving from Huntington Beach to Hemet for my work. And all of a sudden I couldn't put my boots on in the morning. Mm. So I had severe sciatic issues. Oh, so anyway, wow. I found out I had a 10 millimeter L4 S1 herniation. Or L4, L5, and L5 S1. The L5 S1 was the 10 millimeter. So I did everything I could. I immediately stopped my construction work. But anyway, I did everything I could to try to reverse this without having surgery. And I did all these, the self-therapy stuff. The book that saved me and saved so many people from surgery that I've recommended through the years is called Treat Your Own Back by Robin McKenzie.
Okay.
And I did all this stuff. I was even doing the neuromuscular reeducation stuff with Gary Glum. Gary Glum used to write articles in Muscle and Fitness, and he worked with a lot of good athletes and stuff. And I was doing all this stuff to try to get this herniation, since it wasn't a prolapse, it was a herniation, trying to get it to retract mm-hmm. on my own, because there was too many horror stories out there for people that went through back surgery.
Yeah.
And the recovery, and wishing they had never gotten back surgery. And it ruined them. And at that point, I still wanted to get back and compete, right? But my main thing was to get better, because I was in excruciating pain every single day. Mm, and I'm talking fetal position pain.
Jeez,
and so my training had to change. At the same time, John, what happened was, so this is now 85. So that's when Steve O'Brien and I, in July of 85, moved back up to Northern California with Boston's mom. And we were buying shares in the Walnut Creek Golds with Steve. And mm-hmm. I'm doing everything I can to take care of my back. And little by little, with the back inversion table, back in those days, they called it a backswing. You had to literally hang upside down vertical. Mm-hmm. And doing all this self-help stuff with this book and all these different exercises and chiropractors and this neuromuscular reeducation, all these things I was doing, I was able to slowly get out of the sciatic nerve real issue, but it took me a full 2.5-3 years.
Wow.
And during that time, John, what happened?
Surgery.
Yeah. Never had surgery, and knock on wood, to this day, I can, in my back is, oh my gosh, I'm so blessed, because where I was at 30 years old, it could have been life debilitated. I could have been in the wheelchair or something, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
And if I'd had a botched back surgery or something. So I was able to be out of bodybuilding long enough, John. So this is a big deal for me, because, you know, in 84, I was always really very super cautious, to the point where guys would like laugh at me, like, are you kidding me? I don't know if you want me to talk about anabolics or anything, but
sure.
I have to bring it up, because it's part of the real reason what ended my career. Because what it was is I was out of it long enough to, at the whole time I was recovering from this back problem, major issue I had, I was also looking at the big picture and getting more involved and buying more shares and getting more involved in the gym business. Mm-hmm. And I never felt good, because of my sports background and always being natural and clean and everything, I never felt good about the fact that in order to be in the condition you have to be in, obviously, and to compete at a national level, you're not going to be natural. I have to take stuff.
Yeah.
And in 84, I worked with a biochemist, and he brought in, he had these, they called them the DDR drugs, the Blastrone, the Quinolone, mm-hmm. all these drugs that I didn't even know what they were, but I found out what the compounds were. But I went ahead and experimented with that in 84. And so there was a huge difference in thickness and in muscle size and overall just quality of my physique from 82 to 84.
Okay.
And I'm no dummy. I mean, as hard as I trained and as heavy as I trained, I know that, you know, that was a large contributed to the fact that I was taking more stuff than I'd taken before.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel good about it, John. I didn't feel good about it.
Yeah, you didn't feel comfortable.
And so when I had that time off, and as much as I loved training and my bodybuilding and all that, and know that I was cutting myself short on my career, because I, I was just coming into my, I was just starting to get to where, you know what, I actually could, you know, maybe do some damage in the national scene here. You know, if I keep going and you know, keep injury free or whatever, but that certainly didn't happen. So anyway, fast forward, I said, you know what, this is a blessing in disguise.
Mm.
I'm not returning. I'm not going to get back. My training changed. I don't like the drug thing. I'm just going to get more into the gym business. And obviously I'll train my whole life, but I'm just not going to be competitive anymore. And yeah. That was it.
Hmm. So the layoff from the back injury allowed you to see the changes with the drugs and everything. And then you said you didn't want to go back to it.
Yeah, I didn't, John, because you're only as good as your last show. And to be better in each progressing show, you can't be shy about what you're willing to take.
Yeah, right. Not when you're at the national level against all those other guys, right?
No, exactly.
Yeah. And you said those drugs were, what did you call them, John? DDR?
Yeah, dog, rabbit. There was a guy that was, he was a really intelligent guy and he was working with some pros and he called them the East German drugs and DDR he called them. And you know, later on I found out there was always it was Anavar, Drobilin 50, Deca, Test Prop, and I think there was a fifth in there. Uh-huh. But it was just a blend. I think it was just a blend of regular stuff. You made it sound like it was this exotic cocktail that you could only get in Europe or whatever. But I think it was just a blend of regular stuff, you know. It was definitely more MGs than I'd ever taken, you know.
Right.
And it certainly had an effect on my physique.
Yeah.
Well, put it this way, Gold's Classic 82, I was 232 pounds. And, you know, you look at my height and what the guys are competing at now. It's like, are you kidding me? How these guys are I mean, these guys are gigantuan.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
But I didn't, you know, there was no GH back in my day. Well, at least
that's what I was going to say. Yeah, this is before the GH and the insulin.
Yeah, this is, you know, a lot of stuff has come around the pike. But, yeah, so anyway, but I still look back and think, you know what? I'm glad because if I would have stayed, you know, recovered or stayed injury free and continued on, I don't know. I just, you know, I just, health is so important. If you don't have it, you don't have anything else.
Right.
And I was actually fortunate, I believe, that it happened the way it did, because I really didn't, my heart wasn't behind the anabolics.
Yeah.
It really
weren't.
And I'll tell you something, you know, Rod was part of that, because Rod was not, this guy, he barely took anything.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, back in our day, like you could go down to Mexico and get like, the Sibajiji was the diet of a little blue 5-milligrammer.
Uh-huh.
And that son of a gun there, you take one of those and that was, I'll be like, I never forget reading the insert, does not enhance athletic ability.
Right.
I go, are you kidding me? Who wrote this?
Yeah. That's where the medical community lost total legitimacy, right? When they were saying that stuff. Yeah.
But yeah, Rod was really conservative with the anabolics too.
Yeah, I heard about that too. Well, didn't he do like one of the Chet Yorton natural shows, I think? I think he did some natural show when they were first starting. This was back in the 80s. Yeah.
Right. Rod,
what do you think?
You know, Rod had the tattoo on his shoulder, The Animal.
The Animal, right. I remember that. Don, what do you think about these guys now and the amount of stuff they're doing? And we're seeing now people dying at young ages, and you know, like that Dallas McCarver died not too long ago. And I think we're going to see this more and more, don't you, with all the stuff that all these guys are doing?
We are, and it breaks my heart because, you know, John, it's the cardiovascular health that you don't hear about.
Yeah,
you know, that is so tragic that happens with you. I mean, you got your heart. I mean, Rick Grayson really explained it well when they interviewed him about Rich Piana.
Rich Piana, you know, yeah.
Because he, you know, he spent a lot of time with Rich Piana, and he was explaining, it's like your heart, you have a pump. That pump, you know, that pump is only designed to pump and, you know, and to be able to deal with just so much blood and pressure. And that's, you know, and your body, you know, you put all this muscle on, and the way you can explain it is, you know, whether a guy is 300 pounds of, you know, solid muscle, or whether he's, you know, has got some muscle and is largely fat at 300 pounds, it's still the mass. It's still a mass that your body
has to
pump blood to be able to supply, push and pull this blood all day long.
Yeah.
And at the very least, you're going to have this, you know, enlarged heart that's working too hard. And then you start, you know, having issues with plaque and plaque buildup in your arterial walls and, you know, pressures from the tissues. You know, these guys are so massive, the tissues are restricting, you know, the blood, the vascular system and the pressure on the vessels, and these blood pressure counts are extremely high. Of course, your body is going to give out. Your heart has to give out.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's no way it can sustain that. You know, and it's a shame. It's a crying shame. Well, Rich's 46 years old, which, you know, Rich trained in our gym too. He was a Northridge boy. We knew Rich really well, and you know, Boston was in diapers when, you know, almost. I mean, that's all far back. You know, but Rich was in our gym all those years, and then he went over to Hollywood and North Hollywood with his personal training business, and then, you know, he started making it really big. But and then Dallas McCarver, I mean, what is he, 26 years old?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then who's this recent kid that just, Matt
Porter.
Matt Porter.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
34.
So sad.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I don't think a lot of these younger guys really realize the danger of it. You know, they're just, maybe they're so easy to get or whatever, and they just feel like, oh, well, everybody else is doing it, so I'm going to do it too. And they don't understand the side effects, and they don't understand the downside to it.
They don't. And the thing is you have, there's a huge amount of individuals out there that, this is the part that really gets me. They really don't have any business, to me, unless you have the genetic potential to be pro, which, you know, you could talk, you know, that doesn't, it goes in one or not the other, anybody, but
yeah,
you know, who really should be, I mean, you know, if you're at the very end of your genetic potential and you're at that, you know, you're at the, you have done everything you can nutritionally, training, that, you know, and you have maximized your physique and you are not quite there, and then you're going to, you can be smart about it and not damage your health.
Right.
I really feel you can be smart about it and not damage your health. But the overboard thing, you know, it's like more has got to be better. And then you have these, what I was getting at is you got these kids that have no right to do any, you know, and they're like just for the pump or whatever, or just to be socially, you know, be more like recognizable or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just, it's so sad. But getting back to the bodybuilders, you know, it's just that competitiveness, because, you know, when you're feeling good and you're looking good and you're young or whatever, the last thing you're thinking about is ill effects of if something goes wrong. You know, you're just living in the moment. You're living in the moment. You're high on life. I mean, it's an awesome feeling to be big and strong and powerful, as we all know. And it can be addicting. We know how it's. I'll tell you something. When I first, it's psychologically, physiologically, just because of the mental trip of, you know, like Rich Drayson was talking about Rich's deal, you know, he didn't think Rich could accept not being that size, because that's what he identified himself with, being that size, and so did everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just Rich, and to lose that size, you know, you lose, you know, your whole, your identity, your ego gets
yes,
wrapped
tied
up
into
that.
Your identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And I'll tell you something. Even with me, when I finally made that decision, that's it. Because what am I doing? Why do I still be taking anything? I have no right to the, you know, my long term health is more important. But that first decision and following through with it, it's not easy, because you have that certain feeling in the gym. We can't deny it. If you're, anybody's ever taken anything, and they, you know, and the workout pumps, and as far as those pumps staying with you and waking up with those pumps and all that, that's when you're natural, that goes away. And that is really something that's psychologically tough to get used to, where, you know what, this is the new me. This is the new natural me. This is the way it's going to be. It's easier said than done.
Yeah, you're so right. There's such a big psychological component to it that a lot of people don't think about.
It really is.
Yeah. Well, John, listen, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I really enjoyed your stories about the good old days, the golden age of bodybuilding, as they say. And I'm glad we finally got a chance to hook up and have this interview.
Well, thank you, John. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about the old days, and appreciate you reaching out to me. Just when you first contacted me, like, I'm a washed up guy. It's really nice that you did take the time to interview me.
No, I remember you. I remember you from those contests in the 80s. You know, you had the height and you had the good legs, and I remember your physique for sure. You didn't compete that long, but I do remember you. So.
Oh, thanks, John. And I got to tell you, man, I've commented before on your Facebook. You've got a phenomenal, even now. I mean, you're just phenomenal. Your physique, your everything, and your ethic, your work ethic, and your everything, your whole life. Are you still, John? You must be in the gym what, 5-6 days a week?
About 4 or 5. Yeah, 4 or 5 days.
You have that gifted rib cage.
Yeah, and, the big rib cage.
And that you have that Arnold, like that double by that Arnold look.
Yeah.
and then nothing lacking. That one you posted recently, it was a video, I think, of when you were like one, even not maybe not a teenager, but when you were first starting out.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh,
I was
my,
like 21.
That is some excellent footage.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, I appreciate that, John.
Really outstanding.
And I enjoy seeing your son every once in a while at the gym, so I'll tell him that we finally did this interview.
Yeah, he always tells you what a nice guy you are, John. I really appreciate it.
Okay. All right, John. Well, it was great meeting you, and thanks again for the interview, and hopefully we'll get to talk again.
Thanks, John. Nice meeting you. Thanks for spending the time.
All right. Take care.
Take care now. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to John Lloyd for joining us. That was the first time I got to talk to John, and I really enjoyed talking to him. He had a great personality. So right now, we're going to read this article, which comes from, again, the April 1977 issue of Muscle Builder and Power. It's called Confessions of a Girl Who Loves Muscle Man by Janet Charlton. It started at an all-night newsstand. I wasn't sleepy, so I stopped off after an evening out to pick up some magazines. We writers have to keep an eye on our competition, you know. I randomly flipped through a few publications, and I found myself examining a muscle magazine with accelerating interest. Of all things, I shoved aside my usual favorites, Esquire and New Yorker, to get a better look at those bodybuilding stories with titles like How to Get Calves Like Steve Reeves and Lou Ferrigno Shouts, Bring Me the Head of Arnold Schwarzenegger. At first, I limited my reading about bodybuilders to furtive visits to the newsstand, but as I became more intrigued by this undiscovered subculture, I started buying the muscle magazines, much to the shock and disgust of my friends. Male visitors would inevitably pick up a muscle book and gasp, "You mean you actually find these guys appealing?" His tone of voice implying that I must be some kind of lust-crazed pervert or worse. "Don't you know these guys are so overdeveloped they can hardly move? Most of them are gay anyway. Who else would work on their bodies like that?" I began to wonder, why do slender men have this incredible hostility toward bodybuilders? I don't resent the centerfold girls from Playboy or even Raquel Welch for that matter. In spite of the verbal abuse my friends heaped upon me, my fascination with bodybuilders flourished. In fact, whenever possible, I drove past Gold's Gym. How lucky I am to live a half hour from what was described by Muscle Power magazine as the muscle mecca of the world on my way to the beach. I fantasized endlessly about the abundance of huge sweating brutes contained inside. I'd always slow down and try to sneak a peek in the door, or better yet, catch a muscle man coming or going. That was a real score. I'd give him an appreciative honk and a wave. But until this point, I never had the chance to actually meet a bodybuilder. Then one night, a girlfriend of mine phoned. She was celebrating her divorce, so she was having a huge party, quote, with lots of men, unquote, to get herself back into circulation. When I walked into her house in Beverly Hills, it was already jammed with people, the usual crowd, skinny men in tight pants with their shirts unbuttoned to reveal lots of gold chains and little else, or the middle-aged, well-preserved producer types in polyester leisure suits. Already, I was bored. I was looking around for the bar when I suddenly focused on a massive chest and a red shirt leaning against the sink in the kitchen. Hypnotically attracted, I wedged my way through the group toward that fabulous chest with my heart pounding in anticipation. Was that who I thought it was? I tried to keep from fainting. Reporters are supposed to be composed at all times. "Excuse me," I remarked coolly. "Your chest looks familiar. Are you Arnold Schwarzenegger?" He laughed and actually seemed surprised that I recognized him. Me? Not recognize the best-built man of all time? That's a joke. Little did he know about all the time we spent together at the night newsstands. Incidentally, this was before Arnold became a movie star. I immediately launched into my "I'd like to interview you" routine. Besides being my job, it's obviously a great way to get to know people legitimately. One of the best things about Arnold is his voice. It is menacingly deep and authoritatively German-accented. We exchanged phone numbers, and I could tell by the way Arnold was examining my sarong that he was definitely heterosexual and probably had more than an interview in mind. That night, I went to sleep with visions of swastikas dancing in my head. Because I'm a journalist, Hollywood parties, screenings, and publicity events are practically an every night thing for me, with an important event sometimes popping up at the last minute. So I find it hard to make plans. Arnold called me several times during the week, but somehow we couldn't get together. On Friday night, I finished working early and I took off with a girlfriend for a discotheque at the marina. Of all people, I ran into Arnold with the red-headed giant he introduced as Ken Waller. I was frankly surprised to see bodybuilders drinking and carousing till all hours. I later learned that this was the exception rather than the rule. At 2 a.m., we ended up going out to breakfast, and I watched with interest as the two bodybuilders consumed ample portions of eggs, meat, and cottage cheese, leaving the buttered toast untouched. The whole time, I was also staring at Arnold's delectable chest and repressed a compulsive fantasy to tear his shirt off in public and ravish him right there and then. On this first evening with Arnold, I noticed another peculiar circumstance which turned out to be not so funny. Other men consciously avoided me. At first, I found it amusing when men jumped out of Arnold's way and kept a careful distance. I have a friendly demeanor, and to be quite honest, I'm accustomed to male attention. Men invariably smile, chat, and flirt in general, no matter who I'm with, except for Arnold. Suddenly, I might as well have been invisible. Other men were overwhelmed by Arnold's formidable presence, ironically, the very thing I found most appealing about him. I surmise that when you're out with a bodybuilder, men simply do not flirt with you. Even if you see a fellow you know, the most he'll muster up is a weak wave from the other side of the room. This can be devastating to the ego, especially since women freely approach Arnold in a very familiar manner, while men stay frozen in the background. More than once, I've wanted to flatten the boldest and rudest of these female admirers, but I keep these thoughts to myself. No need to further fortify Arnold's ego. Eventually, Arnold invited me to a party at his house in Santa Monica. "There'll be lots of bodybuilders there," he promised with a leer. I couldn't wait. My clothes were laid out a week in advance. Since I don't have any girlfriends with the same admiration for bodybuilders that I possess, I brought along a friend who just loves parties of any kind. When we walked in, I felt like the pages of my well-worn muscle magazines had come to life. Famous bodybuilders reclined everywhere. Franco Colombo, Robbie Robinson, Paul Grant, Denny Gable, Ed Corney, Ken Waller, etc. Arnold's furniture was enormous and heavy, strangely reminiscent of oversized trophies. Later, Arnold admitted that his furniture had indeed been built by the man who makes the huge trophies for the most important muscle contests. I had a laugh when I attended the Mr. California contest, and the winner was given a first prize trophy that took two people to carry and looked just like Arnold's end table. I don't usually go to parties where there's no dancing. To me, it's a basic ingredient of partying. But none of the bodybuilders seemed to care that there was no suitable music or dancing space. Refreshments consisted of big bowls of raw nuts, dried apricots, prunes, peaches, and raisins, plus fresh fruits and assorted cheeses. Not a greasy potato chip in sight. Drinks were fruit juice or red and white wine. No hard liquor. And I never even heard the word drugs mentioned. This took some getting used to. I like music, vodka, and junk food a lot. For some reason, I had anticipated that the female half of the party would resemble a Charo lookalike contest, or maybe four pages from a Fredericks of Hollywood catalog. Was I ever wrong? The girls were not overblown, just healthy looking in the California way. Pretty, but certainly not intimidating. Very quiet and dressed mostly in jeans. Besides a few kinkier types Arnold met in the film business, it was a tame group, except for Joe Weider. He appears to be the undisputed king of the bodybuilder racket. When he's around, everyone wants to talk to him. And when he's not around, they talk about him. Joe gleefully launched into a demonstration of his latest mail-order brainstorm, a leather contraption designed to push and pull the most persistent body into an appetizing shape. Betty Weider told me she's going to do her next TV commercial in a bikini, because everyone who sees her on TV now thinks she's wearing a waist cincher under her leotard or uses trick photography to give her that incredible figure. It's even hard to believe in person. The party started early, about 7 o'clock, and by 11, guests were starting to drift away. There were no incidents of drunkenness or loud behavior, much to my disappointment. Perhaps the muscle men were tired out from a long day of pumping iron and sunbathing. A few of them yawned on their way out that they had to get up at 6:30 to work out in the gym. It was evident to me that late hours, drinking, and carousing are usually not an important part of a bodybuilder's routine. The beach is another story. That's where the bodybuilders really strut their stuff. After their early morning workouts, the muscle men congregate on Venice Beach about 6 blocks from Gold's Gym. During the summer months, you hear a conglomerate of accents as they call out husky greetings to each other. Brooklyn, Swedish, Italian, etc. They come from all over to get in shape for fall competitions here. The beach has outdoor weights and bodybuilding equipment in a fenced-in area surrounded by bleachers. Can you imagine working out with an audience? On any sunny day, you'll find enormously developed tan bodies grunting and sweating under painful weights to the delight of an assortment of voyeurs. Blatant muscle groupies in string bikinis yelling encouragement to the objects of their affection. Jealous wives and girlfriends keeping an eye on their property. Amateur bodybuilders watching their idols. Young men of the homosexual persuasion looking for romance and assorted curiosity seekers. Skin color is very important to bodybuilding competitors, so they take their tanning seriously. The best tanning oils are subjects of discussion, and peeling is likened to a fate worse than death. When Arnold is sunning himself, he has an uncanny knack for attracting hordes of Japanese people with cameras who conspicuously appear on the beach fully clothed to politely ask, "Will you stand up, please? Will you pose with our son?" If Arnold's in no mood to be pestered, they cautiously crouch behind beach umbrellas and secretly long lens him. The ritual of the beach is easily the ultimate social event for bodybuilders. They look their best in bathing suits, and their confidence is a joy to behold. Here in their element, they take time to chat with old friends, show off in front of girls, discuss business developments, and enjoy the camaraderie of their contemporaries and admirers. They jog together and run into the ocean with waves the size of apartment buildings. Not a bad life. Late in the afternoon, they reluctantly fold up their blankets. I notice that many bodybuilders are meticulous. After a day at the beach, I'm as sticky and sandy as a breaded veal cutlet, but they walk away sleek and sandless. They wave goodbye until tomorrow and saunter grandly into the sunset. As you can see, I have permeated the secret world of my fantasies, and it hasn't dampened my enthusiasm one bit. I had heard that living out your fantasies is the quickest way to destroy them. Quite the contrary in my case. I just don't have to waste time at newsstands or thinking about hanging around big men's shops anymore. I picked up a few good habits. I get up earlier and I get more exercise and fresh air and I think about what I eat. The real thing is just fine with me. In fact, I've been watching with interest the progress of an apartment building under construction right across from Muscle Beach with a sensational view of the weight area. But I fear that if I moved there, I'd be distracted to the point of never getting any work done. We freelance writers need cast iron self-discipline, you know. On the other hand, I remember fondly what Mae West once said. Too much of a good thing can be wonderful. Some points to remember for girls considering toying with the affections of a bodybuilder. A, forget about carousing all night and sleeping late. You'll be too tired after all that beach air and exercise anyway. B, keep lots of high-protein food in the house at all times. Learn to love cottage cheese, yogurt, and meat. Keep your ding-dongs well hidden. C, get used to being ignored. No matter how legendary your beauty is, chances are other men will cautiously avoid you and he will get all the attention. D, invest in a full-length mirror. Your muscle man is more interested in looking at his calves than his face. All right, what a classic article by Janet Charlton in the April 1977 issue of Muscle Builder magazine 42 years ago. That's how things were so much different back then during the disco era of bodybuilding. All right, that is it for this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Again, happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. Thanks to Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding podcast. If you want to be a Patreon donor and help donate to the show, just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, we have the Patreon link. And I appreciate anyone who helps contribute to the show. I really do appreciate you guys. All right, that's it for this week. We'll see you guys next week with another interview on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care, everybody.